Are you passionate about resolving conflicts and making positive impact in the world? Then USD's Conflict Management and Resolution Master's Program may be for you. Learn to address conflicts at all levels, from personal disputes to global crises. Join the Kroc School's dedicated community fostering peace and understanding while you acquire practical skills to navigate diverse settings. Apply now and be the change you want to see in the world. Visit sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. That's sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD.
Yes, I vote because I feel like as an African-American female, like I want my voice to be heard. And
conservative values. So I vote very conservative. So I try to vote for candidates that have very conservative viewpoints.
Oh, I don't vote anymore now.
Why not?
Just because I don't.
I vote because it is our right to vote. And I take it seriously.
This is San Diego Decides, a podcast by Voice of San Diego. I'm Sarah Libby, and I'm here with my pal, Rye Rivard.
Hey, Sarah Libby.
Hey. Rye Rivard, what's up?
What's up, Sarah Libby?
It's been a while, man. I mean, not for us personally, but on the podcast.
Yeah. We're back.
We're back. So it's after Labor Day, which means things are starting to kick into gear a little bit. Let's talk about something that you hear a lot about and maybe pay attention to, don't pay attention to.
Freak out about,
don't know what to make of. Talking about polling. Polls.
Polls.
What's
surveys.
Up with them?
Opinion surveys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I wanted to kind of kick this off with one of my favorite moments from the presidential campaign so far, because polls became a weird touchstone in it, and it was just like a really hilarious moment. Let's listen to this. This is between a CNN anchor and a spokesman for Donald Trump's campaign, and it gets a little testy.
All right, well, let me ask you about this. So you say it's not a shakeup, but you guys are down, and it makes
Says
sense
who?
That there would
Says
polls,
who?
Most of them, all of them.
Says who?
Polls. I just told you, I answered your question.
Okay. Which polls?
All of them.
Okay. And your question is?
It's brutal, man. I mean, part of the reason that that went viral is because it's just like a good smackdown. But it also kind of hits at this thing where, like, polls are treated as kind of sacrosanct sometime. As like, well, the polls say you're down, so you must be down. And it's really not that simple. We shared this tweet. This was, like, teed up just for us, like a delicious little gift from David Axelrod. He tweeted this right before we came in here to record this podcast, so I feel like it was fate. And he said, "Polls are so numerous at this point that results vary greatly and everyone can find one they like, yet all are covered as if they're right."
And David Axelrod, the political strategist for President Obama, got him elected, some say.
So let's talk about what goes into a poll. There's what it says, you know, Rye Rivard is up by 10 points. There's who conducted the poll or who paid for the poll, what firm carried it out and who paid them or didn't pay them. And then there's, you know, the questions that go into it. How did they ask questions that determine that Rye Rivard was up? And who did they ask? So there's a lot that goes into it, and every poll is different. And like our friend David Axelrod said, a lot of them show a lot of different results. So let's kind of just walk through whatever we can think of that folks could look for when they are trying to study. You know, like when you read a story, you're going to weigh it differently if it came from a certain reporter, if it ran in the Wall Street Journal, or if it ran on a blog you've never heard of. You know, if you read the headline and then you determine that, oh, actually the content of the story doesn't match this headline at all. You know, you have all these different gauges and filters that you kind of run through in your mind to determine if something is valid or if you believe it. And I feel like people are less familiar with what those are when they're reading a poll. They just kind of believe, oh, this 7 points, that's a lot. Everything's going badly for this person.
And there's a couple different audiences for a lot of polls. Like some polls will come out and they're meant to, get the general public to think something is happening. Like, oh, you know, Hillary Clinton is up or Donald Trump is down or vice versa. And then, you know, you see that on television and you sort of have a takeaway from that. But then there's sort of the political journalist, political operative audience who then, you know, really parses those. And then like Axelrod was suggesting, you just fight over what the poll is. You fight over the sample size. You fight over, did you have the right number of Democrats or Republicans in it? And that alone is a really big point of debate in polling, because you can look at voter registration and you can have, you know, the percentage of Republicans and the percentage of Democrats and the percentage of independents that are registered, or you could do a little bit fancier stuff, which is really the way you want to do it, which is to sort of take turnout from previous years, which is, you know, the percentage of people that are registered that actually tend to show up. And then you think about things like, is there a something on the ballot that's more likely to prompt Democrats to show up or Republicans to show up? And actually, you know, sometimes ballot measures in some states will be targeted to get certain constituents out, like, you know, social issues, you know, things like
Prop 8.
Yeah, Prop 8. It was designed to turn out Republicans or conservatives in California.
Absolutely. So let's kind of run through some of the things. You and I are experts, let's say. We're semi-experts. What are some things that if you see on a poll, just automatically kind of put your guard up? I'm going to throw out registered voters and likely voters. If you see a poll and it includes people who aren't even registered to vote, let alone people who are considered likely to vote, and there's a lot of calculations that go into how they determine if someone is likely to vote, but that's going to throw things off right there if it includes people who aren't even registered to vote. So that's something that you can look at. What else is there?
You know, a big thing is if you can see the entire poll. You know, one of the things we're going to talk about a little later, we have
the old cross tabs,
as they're called. We're going to talk to John Niedstadt, the owner of Competitive Edge Research, a little later in the show, about how he polls. But one of the things that campaigns will do is they release, internal polls, they say. But often what they're doing is just releasing what's called the top line number, which is how their candidate compares to another candidate. And not only will they only release that if their candidate's up, but they often won't release the rest of the poll. And so you don't know what they've asked. You don't know what other things they've asked. You don't know if they've asked leading questions before they ask, who would you vote for? So if you can't see the entire poll, that's a huge red flag.
Right. So you mentioned one thing, you know, whether a campaign paid for a poll. That's something that as a journalist I look at and see, oh, okay, so I need to view this through that lens. They obviously want me to see these results and they're pushing, you know, that message. How many people were polled, you know, a really small sample size. We asked 30 people is probably not very representative of anything. A really big margin of error. Mm-hmm. Is something to look for. So if it says, you know, these candidates are 2 points apart, you know, this candidate's leading by 2 points and the margin of error is 7 points, that means one could really, it means nothing. So that's something. Another thing that I've always been taught to look out for is whether they included cell phones. If it's, you know, a call where you're calling folks on the phone, and we can talk a little bit about the various types of polls that exist now. It used to always be by phone, and now...
Actually, even before that, it was people would walk to people's houses.
Yeah.
Pollsters would sit down in your living room or your kitchen and interview until basically enough people had a telephone to...
I would die to have a pollster come to my house. I would love it.
Well, every 10 years, there's a census. it's a sort of poll.
So they used to only primarily be conducted by phone, and you wanted to look at whether... they included landlines and cell phones because, you know, if you include landlines, you're going to get a lot of probably older people, whereas younger people have exclusively cell phones. And if you don't include cell phones, you're leaving out all these potential, you know, young voters. So that's one thing. Whether or not, especially in California, whether they include Spanish language as an option. And then another thing that I didn't even think of that I learned from 538 polling experts extraordinaire is... whether it was conducted by a live interviewer. Mm-hmm. So I guess a lot of research has shown that that tends to produce better results as opposed to like a robo person.
One of the big polling firms in the country that you'll see a lot of their results, public policy polling, PPP, they, as far as I know, only do automated surveys. And every now and then when they put out a poll, people, you know, sort of trash it. Although actually, you know, if you look at, they're not terrible, but people just say this isn't the sort of gold standard of how you poll people because it's automated.
Yeah, the thing that I always associate with PPP is really weird questions. So you'll see a poll that they conducted and it'll be like, Barack Obama is up by 5 points. And also 99% of Americans believe that baseball is America's pastime. There's like a lot of weird baseball questions or just like really random stuff thrown in there that people seem to gravitate toward.
And another thing, when you're not talking about candidate polling, but about issue polling, particularly on polls, I've learned about the environment, where people say, you know, we really want to do something about climate change. We really care about this issue. You'll see polls that they say, you know, this percent want, you know, like clean water and like clean air, but they're often not talking about the intensity of that desire versus other things. Like if you had thrown in a poll by, say, an environmental group that's polling about, do you want clean water and clean air? People say, yeah. But if you say, do you want that potentially at the expense of jobs in your community? People would be less inclined to say yes. So you have to be careful about, particularly on issue polling, when people say, everybody agrees this thing is good. Not only what have they tested that against, the trade-offs, but whether people care that much about that issue versus all the other issues that they might be considering. You know, you might have a candidate who's very pro-environment, and you might say there's a lot of people that care about the environment, but if the other candidate, if that candidate's opponent, has some other issues that are a little hotter, the polling just doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, and it also, something that comes into play is how well they understand something. Kind of the trope that you always hear is Obamacare polls really badly, but then when you explain to people individual components, do you think people should stay on their parents' insurance until age 26? Well, yes, of course, and that polls magnificently. And so that's something else to take into consideration when it comes to the questions and the wording. So I want to talk about two recent surveys that I came across that are both California-based surveys. I was going through my email and saw the old Cal Speaks poll, which is conducted by Sacramento State and in partnership with a lot of the public radio stations. So KPCC and KPBS, I think, was involved. And there are a couple interesting things that I took away from this. One, this was an online survey, which when I was coming up as a journalist covering campaigns, like I always was taught they're garbage. It's like no one would take that seriously. And both of the polls that I want to talk about are both online only polls. So that kind of blew my mind, just that alone right there. And then I pulled out one question that I think gets to this wording issue that I thought was hilarious. So this is from their press release, kind of touting some of the results and synthesizing them. Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump receives the lowest rating of any candidate or group on a feeling thermometer. 71% give him a negative or
what?
A feeling thermometer. Okay. Certainly you're familiar.
I am not.
71% give him a negative or cold rating, while 17% of Californians have warm feelings toward the Republican nominee. Like, what does that even mean?
I don't know.
Because I can imagine, you know, having lukewarm feelings for somebody and still voting for them.
Yeah.
And I can imagine having warm feelings for somebody and thinking, but I'm still going to vote for this other person because my feelings are warmer for them. So, you know, there are certain ways to phrase questions or to ask things that are just can be actively unhelpful.
Like, who would you want to have a beer with?
Exactly. You know, I think George Bush wins that in a landslide, but that doesn't necessarily mean I want to vote for him.
He's also sober. He's been sober for many years, so he doesn't even drink beer.
You have to have a Diet Coke. That's his move.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good move. Diet Coke's delish. So the other poll that came out in the last week or two was the USC LA Times poll. They have had this partnership for several years. And like I said, my mind was blown that this was an online poll, and not only an online poll, but an online poll conducted by SurveyMonkey. And I just associate that with, like, you know, your friends are having a birthday party for Heather and they want to know what day works best for everyone. And So they sent out this SurveyMonkey, but this is like a legitimate national poll from the greatest university in the history of the earth, USC, and and the LA Times. And it's all online. So I called Dan Schnur, who is the director of the Unruh Institute at USC and who conducted this poll, and was like, what? Tell me about online polling, because apparently it's real now.
And what did he say? Is it real?
It's real. So he said that they've been playing around with online polls since 2012, and that at that point, the LA Times was still nervous about it and didn't want to partner on any online polls at that point. But if you remember back in 2012, there was a big congressional race in the LA area between Berman and Sherman. So they kind of tested the waters with that, and he said that it ended up being relatively accurate, and they've been refining their online polling ever since until it's gotten to the point where they're obviously comfortable enough, you know, using it. So there are a few considerations that he talked to me about that I found really fascinating. And one is this issue, you know, like I said, there's the issue of cell phones versus landlines and who has access to what and who you're most likely to reach. And with online polls, you have to consider people who don't have access to the internet or people who don't have regular access to the internet, because there's a difference there. And so I think that's something that they, you know, try to wait to account for. And then, you know, all of these polls have different methodologies, but one thing he said, and this goes for all polling, I asked him, if you're a voter, what do you look for in a poll to understand if it's legitimate? And he said, you know, I wouldn't look at a poll and say Hillary Clinton is up by 2 points and take that to mean Hillary Clinton is up by 2 points, which is pretty surprising. He said, I would look at a poll that says Hillary Clinton's up by 2 points and look at that same poll and how what it has done over time. And so if Hillary Clinton's up by 2 points, but you know, 6 weeks ago, that same poll said that they were in a dead heat and they were tied. That means she's on an upward trajectory and she has momentum. And that's something that you can probably bank on. Whereas, you know, like that Axelrod quote, this poll says this, this poll says this, and they're all taken as right. But if you look at the same poll, the same methodology, roughly probably the same groups of people being questioned, that's something that is more reliable.
Yeah. One of the people that taught me about polling early in my career was big on trend lines. He said, just look at the trend line, just pay attention to the trend line. And then he repeated that to me every time I called him, just look at the trend line.
Did you look?
I always looked at
the
trend.
Were you looking?
If I could fit that many pieces of paper on my desk, I would look at the trend line. And then there's another kind of a poll that's really not much of a poll at all, but it appears as if it might be a poll. It's called a push poll. And this is really just basically slander in question form.
I love it.
Yeah. And so some of the more dark artists in the political world will use these, and they'll call up and they'll, you know, since this has been in the news lately, they'll ask something like, would you vote for Hillary Clinton if you knew she'd been replaced by a body double? Or, you know, this has happened, like, would you vote for this candidate if you knew that their campaign had been infiltrated by lesbians? That was used against Ann Richards in Texas many years ago. So actually, you know, if you ever get one poll like that, get a call like that, you should actually call us here at Voice of San Diego and let us know.
I want to be the person who gets all of these things. I want a pollster to come knock on my door. I want them to call me, and I want them to send me just like some weird, insidious poll with heinous characterizations of everyone involved. Who are these lucky people who get these? So push polls remind me of another poll. You can't see me using air quotes. Poll that we kind of laugh about a lot in the newsroom. And these are like online polls and Twitter polls. And I see a lot of journalists or newsrooms kind of doing these either on their website or through their Twitter accounts. And like I said, we kind of roll our eyes a lot in the newsroom when we see these. Like, and I feel like those questions, maybe not as insidious as a push poll, but a lot of those, I'm just like, who is writing these? Like, would you vote for Hillary Clinton if you knew she was about to die, kind of thing.
So there's a couple of different like sort of variations of this. There's like the Twitter polls that are done sort of earnestly but misguidedly to actually try and gauge public opinion because you're not really going to get that. It's going to be a sample bias of people who happen to be on Twitter and then follow you, which is a huge sample bias, which means, you know, it's just skewed. It's not representative of the general population at all. And then there are sort of the ironic Twitter polls. And then there's a sort of earnest attempt, particularly on newspaper online polls where they put it on their homepage, it's more fun than anything else.
Yeah, and it can be engaging.
Yeah.
And I understand it. But I guess sort of what angers me as a journalist is it's a bit of like a way to sort of act like you covered a serious or complex issue while doing literally the bare minimum. So if you take, you know, something controversial like police shootings or any of the police issues that have been in the news and you just do an online poll, you can kind of like act like you covered it or act like you care about having a dialogue on something that's really important when that dialogue is kind of meaningless.
And they don't always clearly label them as this is just for fun and games.
Right.
When, again, huge sample bias. It's people who read your newspaper or website who feel like clicking on the thing, who may be voting more than once and are good friends.
And who have access to the internet.
Yeah. And are good friends at the Union Tribune. They do this and they ask some riveting questions. Like, they actually did ask this question back in August. Whose health are you more concerned about? 365 people responded. 60% said Clinton. 18% said Trump. 21% said neither. And then they ask, you know, like sort of less serious questions like, you know, will Joey Bosa actually play a game ever? And like how many games will the Chargers win this season? And the most respondents they got lately was, which do you think is more important to San Diego Comic-Con or the Chargers? And, you know, again, fun and games here, but Comic-Con
one.
Yeah.
Right, but even that, it just like suggests that it's one or the other, that they're in competition somehow, which can be kind of misleading.
Right, and if it's near Comic-Con or at the start of the Chargers season, like they're just not real, but there they are.
But if they get people to read stories that journalists write, I'm into that.
But now we're going to talk to a real pollster, John Nienstedt, the president of Competitive Edge, a local polling and market research firm.
So, John, one thing, you know, we talk a lot about statewide polls and national polls. One thing I'm curious to hear from you is how San Diego is unique and whether it poses any unique challenges in terms of polling. Are there things that you do that you think that other pollsters don't do or do differently? You know, do you have to ask all your questions in Spanish and English, or what are kind of like the interesting things that San Diego offers as far as opportunities or hurdles to polling and taking people's temperatures?
Well, first of all, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me. San Diego is somewhat different. I wouldn't say unique. All big cities are more difficult to do survey research in than, say, rural towns or even smaller cities. People here are busier, so it's more difficult to get a hold of them. And because they're busier, their time is a little bit more compressed. And so doing a 15-minute survey with them over the phone is a little bit more daunting than, say, doing a survey in El Centro or rural Kentucky or Ohio, that sort of thing. So that's a challenge. But you also face that challenge in Los Angeles, New York City when we poll there. We poll across the country. We're a 29-year-old firm that polls all across the country on a variety of issues. Yes, we do a lot of politics, but we also do some consumer research. We do some public affairs research. So it's a pretty broad breadth of work that we do. The question about the Spanish language, we do have a bilingual crew of interviewers when we need it, but typically from a standpoint of polling the electorate, because all voters must be naturalized citizens, at a minimum, and are almost all, are mostly non-naturalized citizens, people that grew up here. As a matter of fact, about 12% of the voters in San Diego County are naturalized citizens. Because the vast majority speak English, I think maybe 2 or 3% speak so much Spanish that they want to do a survey in Spanish. We don't usually have to worry too much about the Spanish language element of the survey research game.
Got it. So say I'm a candidate in San Diego who comes to you. Can you just walk me through what the process is like? Obviously, I want to know if I have a chance to win. But are people usually just as interested in issues and whether that impacts their candidacy, or just how does that all work when somebody comes to you?
Sure, Sarah. Usually the people that come to me are not the candidates themselves. They're the consultants for the candidates. A wise candidate has and candidate that's serious usually is hired a consultant. I make my relationships as from a business standpoint with the consultants, not so much with the candidates. That said, I have a lot of great relationships with the candidates, but they usually come after I've met the consultant and then I develop a relationship with the candidate. And I love those sorts of situations. I feel very invested, and the more helpful I can be in a situation like that where I have a personal relationship with the candidate, the better. They are going to want to know how to win. And the consultant is going to want to know how to win as efficiently as possible. My job is to, with evidence based upon the survey data that we collect, do that. Give them advice on how to win. It's as simple as that and as complex as that. Think of all the things that go into winning. Understanding what people think about the issues, understanding how they make up their minds, understanding where they get their information, understanding what messages and themes that are on their mind, those sorts of things, what people they respect, what people they find credible as endorsers, those are also very important elements to winning. But the basic foundation is to understand why things are the way they are. A media pollster is not so concerned with understanding why the things are the way they are. They are more interested in the horse race. So when you look at Politico and you see the Real Clear Politics sort of view of an election, you're looking at a horse race. To my mind, that's almost akin to a parlor trick in my business. It's just there. It's kind of interesting to look at. But what really matters for a campaign pollster or anybody involved in even public affairs polling is to understand why things are the way they are, the underlying dynamic of the electorate.
So something that I feel like I've always been taught as a political journalist is, you know, we get during campaign season all kinds of things thrown our way. Here's this Oppo research I want you to publish to make this candidate look bad. And one of the lessons that you always learn is internal polls from candidates are bad. And you don't want to publish a story that says Kevin Faulkner is up by 50 points according to an internal poll conducted by Kevin Faulkner. But you're probably somebody who has conducted some of those internal polls. So what's your reaction to that? And is that, you know, crap, or is there a reason for that?
The only reason internal polls should be thought of as lesser would be just because the campaign is not going to want you to publish an internal poll that doesn't fit their narrative. The internal poll should be done correctly. And the media poll should also be done correctly. But the media poll, the reason the media poll isn't quite as valuable is they're, again, not looking for the why. And the why is the real story that you want to get into, which the internal poll is really going to be focused on. A good internal poll is going to not only get the horse race correct, but it's also going to understand why things are the way they are. So they're both valuable. They should be both valuable in their own way, but a reporter is only going to get from that internal source, on that internal poll, the one that the campaign wants you to see.
Right. So it's not necessarily that the poll itself is bad or was done badly or is inaccurate. It's just that, you know, you're just kind of carrying their water for them as a journalist, which is inappropriate.
Yeah. In a prior job, the internal polls that I was sent mostly weren't the whole poll. It was sort of the top line number that made the candidate look best. And obviously when the polling was making the candidate look good, you didn't get the, you know, message testing and all this stuff in the rest of the poll, except very rarely. Is there a Do you talk to the consultants about, yeah, throw this thing out there that would make us look good? Or do you say, don't ever release my stuff? That wouldn't be good. I mean, who makes that decision to float it out?
Well, the candidate or the campaign, it's their poll. They can do what they want with it. But my relationship with my clients is, if you put something out there and the press calls me on it, I have to talk about it, right? So be very judicious with what you put out there. I'm not going to allow Competitive Edge's name to be associated with something that is sleazy or cheesy or anything like that, because that's not what we do. We're, again, a 29-year-old firm that prides itself on having developed a great reputation here locally and across the country. So my clients are aware of that. So it's pretty, it's not all that often that we, that the clients I work with are putting out public consumption the results of our polls.
Can you talk at all about what goes into how you formulate questions, and particularly what goes into the wording of questions? Because, you know, this is something we run into as journalists all the time. There's 20 different ways to say the same thing. And, you know, it has the potential to skew people's answers pretty considerably depending on how you ask a certain question. So how does that process work?
Yeah, exactly right. Some of the changes, even subtle changes, could produce significant differences in the results. Some of them are done innocuously or because maybe just pure shoddiness, and others are done from questions are changed or wording is changed or used for reasons that the consultant or somebody wants to change public opinion because they release the data based upon the results that they got from that worded question. I'm going to use, if I can, something that's already been out there. The Chargers released a poll results from a survey they did. This is way back in 2015. And their question about the stadium and a stadium proposal was, do you favor or oppose the city and the county spending $400 million to build a new NFL football stadium in the Mission Valley area of San Diego? Now, that got a 61% oppose response at the time and 33% favor at the time. Well, I pointed out that when this was touted to me, it says, well, the question itself, if you read it carefully, what is a respondent supposed to say? Because you're putting the emphasis on the city and county spending $400 million. That's what you're responding to. You're not responding to a package or a proposition or an initiative. You're responding to whether they should spend that money. The default is going to be no. Contrast that with the question that we asked around the same time, and we put it in the form of a proposition that might appear on the ballot. We said Proposition 1 may appear on the ballot. It approves building a roughly $1 billion modern football stadium, which the city and county would own, on the Qualcomm Stadium site. About two-thirds of the cost would be paid by the NFL, the Chargers, and corporate sponsors. About one-third of the cost would be paid by city and county government. If the election were held today, would you vote yes to approve Proposition 1 or no to reject it? Now, that's replicating what could appear on the ballot. The first one that the Chargers were asking doesn't come close to replicating what would appear on the ballot. So when you think about how to ask a question, you want it to be as real world as possible. Otherwise, you're going to start distorting what public opinion is.
One of the words that's always intrigued me that's in polls is when they ask if you want to reform something. And reform is one of those words that it could mean so many different things to so many different people. Do you ever try and avoid certain words that are obviously open to interpretation?
Well, you know, I guess everything could be open to interpretation. I try and look at it from the standpoint of what are we really trying to understand that's actually out there in the public. The more we get away from that, the more we inject certain words into the question, the more we're going to change what public opinion really is. And the desire I always have is to understand public opinion as it is. That's what we really want to do. Now, we also do message testing. So in that situation, yeah, you're going to test a message in the vernacular of whatever it is that we're trying to look at, whatever issue we're trying to look at. And there's more license. But in that situation, you're then trying to understand how that message plays. It's a different concept than actually asking the question about what public opinion is now, currently.
Can you give us a message that you might test?
I don't know. Supporters say Mayor Faulkner's a great mayor because he paves roads and is looking out for the citizens of San Diego. Is that a good reason to vote for him? Somewhat good reason, strongly good reason, that sort of thing.
So you've been doing this a long time in a lot of different races. Rye had the question. I'm going to ask it. I'm taking credit for Rye. What's the farthest off you've ever been? And can you talk about why you think that happened? Or just we kind of want to hear some horror stories.
Oh, come on.
And then you can go with your most accurate and spot on.
Yeah, how about we start with that?
The time you were perfect, which is always except for this one story that you're going to tell us.
I've got a lot of stories. One thing that I'm extremely proud of is that we've called the winner in every mayor's race in San Diego since 1992. Obviously, I'm a native San Diegan, so we do a lot of work here. That's really, I love the fact that we've been involved in those that many mayoral races and have been so accurate. Another story on the positive side, I'll get to a negative one, but let me tell you a positive or a situation that taught me a lot. So back in the early 90s, there was a city council race in District 8, and there were a lot of candidates running, one of whom was somebody nobody had ever heard of, was Juan Vargas. And Mike Geary was in that race. Another fairly high-profile people were in that race. And we said, okay, we're going to do a survey here. It wasn't for any candidate. This was for the Daily Transcript, actually. And we said, we'd do the survey and put it out there. And as we were doing the survey, I had to go to New York for business. And I'm in New York. It's February. It's cold. And I get the kind of early results, and it shows this Juan Vargas guy in the lead. And I'm like, well, that can't be right, guys. You know, back home, that can't be right. You know, get another 100 surveys. So they dutifully went in the field and got another 100 surveys, and it just turned out the same thing happened in the second version, you know, the extra 100 surveys. So we published it, and 2 weeks later, Juan Vargas won the race. And of course, I took credit for it. Oh, I knew it all along, sort of thing. But the point being that you have to, if you do the poll correctly, if you conduct it correctly and you use the right methods, you design the questionnaire correctly, you sample correctly, you analyze it correctly, everything's done right, you got to believe in your polling numbers. You have to do that. I've learned that over time and time again, that trust the numbers that you've got. Okay, so you asked for a negative.
I was going to say, that can't be your horror story. You just did the thing like in a job interview where I ask you for your negative qualities and you're like, oh, I'm a perfectionist. I'm always on time. It's a real problem.
I work too hard.
Negative. There have been some occasions where I learn from the outcome. So let's say where we might be a little off on a result. What happens is we realize, oh, after the fact, we didn't have enough Republicans in our sample. And so we use that as a learning sort of tool. As a matter of fact, every poll that we ever do, we keep track of it, and then we go to the situation after the election and we look and see how far off we were. Right now, coming to mind, I don't have a specific example where we were off by more than the margin of sampling error, but I'm sure there have been some. If you're involved in polling, you have to realize you have that margin of sampling error. So that's first and foremost. If your sample size is 400, your margin of sampling error is going to be plus or minus 5%. So there's, you know,
a big range. Yeah.
It can be a large range. And in a very close election, you can have a situation where, you know, you're still within the margin of error, but you're off by the amount that showed that your candidate was going to win, and he actually loses or she actually loses. So you're always involved in that. But the other thing is, you're doing the survey. It might be 2 weeks out. It might be a week out. It's a competitive campaign. People change their mind. I mean, they just change their mind, or they don't show up to vote, or they do show up to vote in ways that you can't anticipate. So that's another reason why the horse race is good. It's interesting. You want to be as accurate as possible. But the real value to is the understanding of the underlying dynamic, because that's how you can get into understanding how to change public opinion or how to work with the public opinion is there once you understand it.
You talked about going back and saying, oh, in this race, we didn't survey enough Republicans in this particular instance. Do you find that you're usually able to identify something you could have or should have done better to be closer?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I believe that the best way to learn is from your failures rather than your successes. For instance, in this last race, the June race, we initially believed that based upon other primaries that Republicans would have a huge turnout and Democrats would have less of a turnout, about 80% less turnout or 80% of the turnout that we had seen in 2008 and 2012 for Democrats, and about 130% what we had seen in 2008 and 2012 for Republicans. So when we were doing our polls in, say, March for our candidates, we gave them two scenarios, kind of a normal scenario and then a Republican wave sort of scenario. Well, for my Republican candidates, that was helpful, and they like that, of course. As we all know, in Indiana, Donald Trump knocked out the two remaining Republican candidates. So when we got around to California, it was the Democrats that had the competitive race and the Republicans didn't. So that completely flipped, and we had a situation where there was a huge Democrat turnout relative to Republicans, something we've never seen before in primary elections. So that's something the takeaway there is, you know, try and you can't predict everything that's going to happen, but do your best to try and use the information at hand to make a good prediction. Of course, once we saw that happen, once we started seeing this happen in subsequent polls nearer, closer to the election, we figured that we baked that into our numbers. But the early numbers were way off because of that.
There's this amazing scene in the new Anthony Weiner documentary where he's on the phone with one of his consultants and they say, you're going to lose this thing and you're going to lose it bad, and here's probably what your percentage is. And, you know, towards the end of a campaign, sometimes consultants will say things like, oh, it's going to be close. It's going to come down to, you know, turnout, you know, publicly. And then like 5 minutes after the race is called, they're like, yeah, we were doomed. We're lucky to get by with that one. You're in the room. You're so good at this. you're in the room and you're telling people this one's over. You're out, buddy. What's been the kind of reaction from candidates when you give them the crystal ball and they know this thing they put a lot of time in to is doomed?
Well, some disbelieve the polling results. There was a client in 2014. We did a series of polls for the gentleman, and at some point I said, I don't think this is going to happen. I think there's a lot of smart people in this room, the consultants and everything, and they can work magic. They can work very hard and do the right thing, and the polling is good, and the polling shows that you're not going to have a shot. And he decided to continue on and even double down, I guess you could say. And sure enough, on election day, he lost badly. He called me up the next day and said, well, I guess polling is right. You know? And I'm kind of surprised at those situations.
Wow, I've never heard of a politician giving a concession call to a pollster. Buddy, you were right.
Yeah, you were right. Yeah. Folks pay me a significant amount of money to understand the electorate and to understand what public opinion is, and they're free to go with it or not. I've had a surprising number of clients. I wouldn't say ignore, but kind of understand the numbers and then choose to do something different from what I would expect them to do. And it's a free country. You can do that.
You sure can. And it sure is. John needs it. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Sarah.
Okay, Rye, if you took a poll of just yourself, a one-person poll, what would that poll reveal was your favorite thing that happened this week?
I'm going to go back to something we talked about with John, which is the Anthony Weiner documentary, Weiner. I watched that very recently, and I've been thinking about it a lot ever since, because it's an inside view of a complete disaster of a campaign. and an unfortunate precursor and preview of the separation of Mr. Weiner from his wife, Huma Abedin, an aide to Hillary Clinton. And you can just watching her go through this miserable experience, having her husband campaign for mayor of New York, you just see just despair, really, or you feel it anyway. It's quite a scene. It shows, yeah.
It's quite a scene, and it's just like, what a soldier she is. So I saw this, I saw the documentary before the latest Weiner news came out, and even then, just like, what a soldier she is, all that she's been through, and she's still just this composed goddess who's trying as hard as she can to help her husband, and it doesn't look fun.
But there, you know, it wasn't. It's not only a behind the scenes look at a campaign in disarray, but there are these moments where Weiner is just he's a political genius at times.
Absolutely, like, he's just electric.
He enters this lion's den of opposition to him. He gets the question like, "You're a jerk. Why should we trust you?" And he gives a beautiful, beautiful answer. And it's just like, it's electrifying. He gives this great answer for his campaign and why it matters and why running for office matters and why he's doing it, why New York needs him. And then clearly very few people in New York agree with him, but it's just the dichotomy of it's astounding.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great favorite thing. So my favorite thing this week is both a favorite thing and also a least favorite thing. And that is the return of football, particularly college football. So as I mentioned, I am a USC fan, which of the last few years has been a little rough. Mm-hmm. But I like inherited these terrible traits from my dad and my brother where like I cared very, very deeply about my team and about Oregon. And it's actually agonizing. Like I don't enjoy football anymore. It's like only a relief when my team wins, and it's just like agony the rest of the time.
Especially that opener there against Alabama.
I don't want to talk about it.
No, but the opener against Alabama, that was probably particular agony.
I don't want to talk about it though. So, you know, we've got PolitiFest coming up, and I was recently delighted because I found out USC is playing on Friday that week, which means I can watch the game, and also I don't have to worry about, you know, not having my favorite game day shirt on at PolitiFest because I'll be wearing a VOSD t-shirt and rocking it.
If you would lose again like you did to Alabama, would you would you be a little despondent on Saturday?
Yeah, absolutely. I like avoid the internet and people who want to talk about the game. Scott Lewis would probably want to talk about the game because they're playing Utah. So, you know, maybe him and I will be beefing at PolitiFest. You should probably come and find out.
Definitely. You should come. It's on the 24th of September. It's at San Diego State. You should come.
Yeah, it's going to be rad. Everybody should come. That's my favorite thing for the next podcast already.
Excellent. And we'll see you then.